for sake of continuity, how little can I say? Well, the last major section in this chapter that we just finished was the goal of family life, unity of purpose. And that unity of purpose is to cultivate genuine love on a foundational unity of purpose. And that purpose, what is that unity of purpose? It's the same purpose that Christian friendship has, a shared,
what is the word?
Telos.
I'm trying to share
something. Exact. What?
Telos, right?
Well, the telos is the kingdom of God. The goal is, now you're talking, that's different.
Shared pursuit of purity of heart.
Yes, it is a... The Christian friendship is based on a shared purity of heart, and the spiritual effort that needs to be made involves the virtues, and the ultimate end of things, the telos, is the kingdom of God. And that applies to any friendship, and it applies also to marriage between a man and a woman. And having talked about the relationship between the father and the mother, it also applies to the relationship between the members of the family, and we have just turned to the relationship between the children and the parents, not just between parents and children, but also between brother and sister, sister and brother. And that relationship also is based on a unity of purpose in the family, and that purpose is to have a shared purity of heart. That is the goal from day to day. Top of page 103, as we've said, in striving for purity of heart and the kingdom of God through unity of purpose, a family presents an opportunity to develop Christian love in the same ways we develop it within any other set of relationships. And what are those ways? There are three of them. First, doing good to one another, showing genuine compassion, and humbling ourselves to each other. Now, what that means in a family is much more intimate than it is in friendships outside the family. And remember, this is an application of the spiritual life as described in the councils that were described by who? Who is our writer? Our writer is... No, not that guy. The guy back in the 4th century who went to the east from the west. He went to the east. He spoke to the spiritual fathers of the desert, Abba Moses. Moses the Black is one of the people who is quoted in this writing. But who is the person who wrote the conferences? I've forgotten. John Cassian. John Cassian. Okay. Now we're up to date. So these three ways of developing Christian love in the family are exactly the same ways that you develop Christian love in your spiritual effort in the desert. And they've been applied to Christian friendships, and now they're being applied specifically to family life. Opperwall says, we have ample opportunities for practicing these virtues within a family. The way they are practiced within a family is, how can I say, in a sense, more challenging in a certain kind of way, but in another way, there are just so many opportunities to do it. What I'm thinking of is doing good to one another. We can think of, you know, parents want to do good, the mother wants to do good to the father, and the father to the mother, and the parents to the children. But there is a worldly way of going about that, which Christian love goes beyond. That's the critical thing. So it's not just practical life from the monks in the desert as to how to go about living a secular family life based on worldly values. It's advice on how to go from that beyond that so that you can share purity of heart. Shared purity of heart is what you need to work on having in common. It doesn't just come by the way of natural relationships between mother and father and parents and children. But there are lots of opportunities for practicing these virtues. The second one, showing genuine compassion, it's a compassion that goes beyond natural compassion. We'll talk about that in a minute. And humbling ourselves to each other. We had just talked about that last time. And some time was spent focusing on how subtle it is. It takes some time to think about what it means to be humble before the love that you have for your children. Humility before your children, at first we think that it might conflict with the idea of the authority of the parents, but only if you're thinking about it in a secular way. If you're thinking about it in Christian terms, the humility that you have before your children has to do with the shared purity of heart and the love that you don't want to damage, the spiritual welfare of your children that you don't want to damage. And so you use discretion and discernment in order to avoid that. And it is not possible without humility. So those kinds of opportunities, in a certain kind of way, unique to family life, are available in ample quantities, occasions. Nowhere else are we more likely to see the needs of another person so as to provide charity. Now, charity, we have a secular idea of charity, where charity means giving people handouts that they don't deserve, and that is certainly not the understanding that Christians have of the term charity. In fact, sometimes it's most directly the word that is translated into charity is agape, exactly Christian love. You know, so there's more involved here. I made some notes to myself. One way of understanding charity is that charity, this agape, is a self-sacrificial love using discretion. Remember, discretion, what we mean by discretion is that we are concerned not to overburden the person that we are concerned for by just laying down the law in a kind of unfeeling kind of way. We take into account what the person is ready for, what they can understand, what they can absorb, what they can benefit from. And a parent, for example, will not put more on their children than they can benefit from. And in a legalistic kind of way, a parent might be justified in just lowering the boom on a child, but because of the fact that there is this charitable love, this agape, this concern for the spiritual welfare of the person, and this environment of shared purity of heart, you don't operate like that. You don't want to damage the relationship of purity of heart, and you correct the child, but only to the degree that they're going to be able to respond. That's discretion, being discreet enough to realize what the right thing is to say at the right time, just that much and no more. Part of that is being charitable. You can see where that is being charitable in a spiritual sense. Nowhere else are we more likely to see the needs of another person, to provide charity, or be exposed to the inner workings of the mind and soul so as to suffer along with them. Suffering along with our children is something that we are called upon to do as parents. Children come to learn to suffer along with their parents as they grow older. So every member of the family is called upon to exercise this kind of spiritual effort. We find ourselves in a position in family life to exercise patience. Every member of the family does. If nothing else, our simple proximity, the closeness physically to one another in a family, can and should become an opportunity to exercise even more fully the virtues that are required to turn any relationship into a site, a place for the realization of the kingdom of God. Without these virtues, we can't even do this kind of spiritual effort. So we have to be working on our own virtues in order to be able to engage our children in this kind of way. And our children, we are hoping, we are praying, we are concerned that they develop the same sort of effort to focus on the virtues that are necessary in order for them to be close to their parents. So this is a real family discipline that we're talking about. The fathers who are interviewed by John Cassian in the conferences see family relationships, Opperwall says, as spiritually unique. Not unique in the sense that they are different from other Christian relationships. They are based on the same realities between human beings, spiritual realities. They're different because there is an advantage in family life over our relationships with other people in our lives because of something in particular that has to do with family life, something that is there at a natural level. You can compare this to what you have to begin with in a wedding. Our understanding is that when two people come to bring their wedded life into the Orthodox Church, there is already something there. There is love at a natural level between these two people. They have each seen something in the other person that draws them one to the other at a natural level, and hopefully a seed of something that goes beyond that as well. And if that seed is going to grow and be fulfilled in the kingdom of God, which is the only place that it can be fully fulfilled, that relationship is brought into the church. And what could only have been a natural relationship without bringing it into the common shared life of all of the people of the body of Christ, the two people have the opportunity to develop a spiritual life that goes beyond the natural love. And a Christian friendship, you know, the foundation of that marriage, you can compare that situation to a situation that Opperwall is going to describe here, because there is something natural that already exists in a family between a man and a woman who become the parents of children. There is a natural family cohesiveness, a natural family sense of responsibility, and the parents are protective of their children. Their children have a dependency on their parents. All of this at a natural level. So you've got something that is good at a natural level, but if it's going to go beyond that and be fulfilled, it's got to go through this spiritual process of having this shared common goal, of having a shared purity of heart, and all of the effort of spiritual life has to be taking place in that family. Otherwise, it'll just stay a natural relationship. Opperwall will describe in the next few paragraphs how lots of times people get married, have children, and assume that married life, the natural love between a man and a woman and the parents for their children and their children, loyalty to their parents, all at a natural level, that's what you've got to work with. That's the foundation. And if it goes wrong, it's because something went wrong at that level. That's a completely wrong way of understanding things. It would be comparable to two people falling in love and expecting romantic love to be able to bear up under all of the weight of the reality of married life. It's totally unrealistic. Now, there's something good about this natural love between a man and a woman, even the romantic part of it. But you can't depend on it as though it were the original source of something that can just be preserved. You've got to take that, bring it into the life in Christ, and begin to make this shared spiritual effort to fulfill the life that we've been given by Christ that goes beyond the natural life, the natural romantic life, or the natural family life. Okay, and so he begins to talk about this natural life and this particular uniqueness of marriage. People in families, according to the fathers, are naturally disposed toward treating one another with a particular kind of affection. Parents who love their children, children who love their parents, they know about this. Abba Joseph says, this is another kind of love, one that is brought about from natural instinct and the rules of blood relationships. And this kind of natural love serves to keep parents and children bound to one another. Sometimes in the beginning, you've got to hold on to that while you're developing more. If you don't begin to develop more, then it can erode. You lose that initial advantage of that natural love. With this kind of love, a person's clansmen, members of the same tribe or clan or class in society. With this kind of love, a person's clansmen, spouse, parents, brothers and sisters, or children are all naturally preferred to anyone else. It's a kind of natural holding together. This is observed not just in the human species, but also with every bird and animal. Even animals protect and defend their nestlings or their babies by natural instinct, to the point that they are often not afraid to expose themselves to risk, even death, on behalf of them. The protective instinct is one of the stronger emotional forces that can bind people together. It is a natural instinct in the most literal sense, seen in human beings and also in animals. Abba Joseph, though, is quick to note that the protective instinct is still a worldly force, a natural force, one that does not necessarily last eternally. A bond such as this, Abba Joseph teaches, can break down for all sorts of reasons, and it does, even in the family, especially if you're depending on it as though you believe that your spiritual effort should be to maintain those natural bonds. If you are a worldly person, that's the only kind of love, that's the only kind of relationship you'll understand. And some people try to use religion, all sorts of religions, to hold that together, that natural bond. That natural bond. It's not enough. Often, separation of place, people moving from one place to another or being separated by distance, breaks off relationships, or losing touch over time and through silence. Sometimes people will just grow quiet and there's no continuation of active relationship. These relationships usually come from connections that have to do with economic advantage. People get married for reasons like that. This looks like a person who is going to be successful. And then when they're not, there's a problem. Desire, not a sufficient foundation. Family relations or acquaintance, just because you kind of seem to get along, are let go as soon as some cause for division gets in the way. You've got to move beyond that, or it will fall apart. Family relationships based on simple fondness and natural instinct descend into dysfunction and estrangement. There's nothing about the natural protective instinct that makes it necessarily permanent. The instinctive ties that bind people together into families are not enough to hold human beings together in love. And now we're not talking just about romantic love or natural love between people. We're talking about the ultimate reality of love that is God. We need to come to participate in that reality by way of our relationships, our Christian friendships in the family. Number one, between the husband and wife to begin with, but also between other members of the family. It's not uncommon today, Popplewell says, to encounter people who seem to expect that family members will love one another and carry on loving one another out of sheer natural disposition. Otherwise, some people will say, we are incompatible. We talked about incompatibility a lot the other week because, it's probably because I'm just an exceptionally difficult person. I can't imagine being compatible myself with anyone. Although we visited up in North Carolina for our granddaughter Rachel's graduation this past weekend, and our son-in-law, David, his parents were there, Jim and
Beverly.
And Beverly remarked to me at one point that she and her husband just were naturally compatible, which fascinated me. And I was I was tempted, you know, to pump her on that, for this unusual situation that I've so rarely run into, but I didn't get the opportunity. But evidently, there are, as Anna was concerned, aren't people, when she was here the other week, she said, aren't there people who just naturally get along? There are, I think. Although sometimes I wonder, is it because one person is dominant and the other person is willing to submit? But yes, because that's one way of getting along. Are there people who just naturally get along in such a way that there is no kind of unfairness or exploitation? Evidently there are. You know, my son-in-law's parents, possibly. I'm not sure.
Two dominants cannot be compatible, for sure.
A dominant and a subservient, especially in when it comes to worldly power, would not be considered compatibility. It's just dominance and subservience. I mean, it's a way of keeping peace, but there's certainly not going to be spiritual development, at least not on the part of the dominant one. The subservient one, possibly, depending. We'd have to talk about the spiritual development of a person who submits to that kind of a relationship. But then on the other hand, you know, you risk extreme situations where there's abuse, you know, emotional, psychological, or even physical. So you're into some dangerous areas there. There needs to be effort, spiritual effort made on the part of both people. Now, people can start out one dominant and one less dominant. Eventually, in most cases, the person who is less dominant will rebel, and then you have to deal with it. And then you find out if there's any love going on there or not. So you're off and running. That's the beginning of the real marriage. Really gets underway at that point. Expectation of natural love can be and often is used as an excuse for neglecting the spiritual needs of our family relationships. If you loved me, you wouldn't do this. Natural love. You're depending on some love that was. You used to love me before we were married, and now you're like this, you know, and you've betrayed our love that we had before. And there is an idealization of premarital affection, but at the same time, a rejection of, probably on the part of both people, of going beyond that. So that's a problem. Natural instinct within a family is not sufficient ground on which to develop real Christian love. So, just like we said before, the assumption that we're starting out with love and going from there is wrong, because the love that we're starting out with is a natural love, and it's insufficient. It's a place to start. At least you found somebody you like. There used to be arranged marriages, and spiritual development was still possible. Now at least we get to pick the person that we want to be married to, and there may be a natural instinctual love between the people, but it's not a good enough ground to develop Christian love that has to do with a shared purity of heart. There's a goal. That's where we make our mistake. There's a goal. We start with natural love, and the goal is to have a married life where there is a common effort to share purity of heart. This is new. This is not something that we just get along with just getting married. Okay, Abba Joseph teaches real love can only be built when family relationships begin to become true Christian friendships and foster unity of purpose, as we have seen. And then he's going to go on and talk about how this protective instinct of natural love can be helpful in our effort to develop Christian friendship. What he's focusing on here is exactly the way that Abba Joseph was saying there is something unique about family life. This protective instinct that we start out with, this natural love in the family, can be helpful in spiritual effort, if the spiritual effort is embraced. So, okay, finally, that's a lot longer time before I be quiet and ask people for some input, questions, observations, conversation. Usually don't take that long, but today I did. So, what do people think? Does this follow? Does it make sense? Is it holding together? Is there something that doesn't fit in with a way of understanding things that anyone has?
I don't see any disconnect.
All seems to come together. Okay, I'm going to throw in throw a wrench into this so that we can have a discussion. Anybody already have a wrench, or shall I use mine?
Use yours.
Okay.
You probably got a good wrench.
Oh, I think it's a good one. Leo Tolstoy, Russian, Orthodox, grew up Orthodox. ran into a conflict with the church. Basically began to think in terms of his own spirituality and was excommunicated in 1901, I forget when. Anyway, beginning of the 20th century. He has a very famous line that begins his book, Anna Karenina. Anybody? College student? Okay, I cheated. I wrote it down. Happy families are alike. Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. What do you think?
Who said that?
Leo Tolstoy. Those are the first sentences of his book, Anna Karenina. Anna Karenina is the heroine of a story where Leo, one of the things Tolstoy points out is that men can go out, you know, have affairs, and people expect it, the family stays together. Anna Karenina goes out and she leads a wild life and everything falls apart. It's not fair. Well, the idea that men can go out and have affairs is not a good place to start. You know, society accepted it at that time, you know, but it's not the way it should be. It's certainly not Christian, you know, way of understanding family life. But anyway, this is what he said. Are happy families all alike? Is it true that each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way?
I don't think. Probably each unhappy family.
I'll give you a hint so nobody gets
embarrassed. I would say it's just the opposite. I think all happy families are more unique than alike.
I think that's
the... I would say that whenever you have an unhappy family, you can pretty much put it down to, you know, half a dozen different causes that everybody has problems with.
Right.
Say...
So Tolstoy is wrong.
Could be.
Yep.
Orthodox writers seem to agree that he was wrong.
That's why I had to communicate.
Well, they're related. They're, you know, those two things are definitely related. But that's how it seemed to him. Now, his family life was a mess, largely because of choices that he made. You know, his wife ended up saying, "I've been married to this man for 45 years, and I don't know him at all." You know, and you know, it's just he did a lot of things that he ought not to have done. But from his point of view, which is basically a secular point of view that focuses on oneself, that's the way it is. Well, he has the experience of unhappy family life. Happy family life, from Tolstoy's point of view, basically is about who are these happy families? Families that have enough money, families that have enough have a good position in the world, families that have a good education, families that have a nice house, you know, they can be happy. You know, and they're all alike. Those people may all be alike, but it's because they are worldly and successful. And whether or not that's happiness, it may be happiness from Tolstoy's point of view because he hasn't got it. But then on the other hand, Tolstoy is he shoots himself in the foot a lot. You know, if that's what he really wanted, he wouldn't have made all the choices that he did. I mean, if that was his idea of happiness, he ought to have gone about things in a very different way. He was very concerned about spiritual life, but he was also very confused. He's a great genius, a great writer, a great novelist, but as an artist, he's at odds with the spiritual tradition of recognizing the spiritual reality of things. So as it would be traditional for, and I look for some examples. What do Orthodox say about Tolstoy's comment? Frederica Matthews Green was kind to Tolstoy. She said, the author Tolstoy wrote that happy families are all alike. And maybe they are alike in not expecting to be happy all the time. Perhaps they expect that problems and disappointments are going to come and expect to take them in stride. In real marriage, not the TV show myth, the dishes get dirty, the wife gets plump, the husband gets bald, and everyone gets grumpy, at least occasionally. In the course of a lifetime together, everyone will need forgiveness, and happy families learn that giving it is the best way to be sure to receive it in return. So that is a happy family, In other words, a happy family is a family that is struggling with its vices and trying to have a shared purity of heart. There is a commitment to that shared effort on the part of all of the members of the family, and there is a common goal that is going on, and that's why they're happy. And if Jimmy were here, he would be likely to mention something that I've often pointed out to him and that I know he thoroughly agrees with, that when we sin, if we do something that we ought not to have done, it makes us like everyone else who has ever committed that sin. Murderers are all alike. They become less who they are. People who make their living by stealing, they are like all other thieves. They become less and less unique. The more we engage in vices, the more we become like anyone else who engages in that particular vice. So we become less like ourselves. And it would stand to reason that the same thing would apply when it comes to family life. If in family life, some family is plagued by some particular thing that Tolstoy would say they're unhappy in their own particular way, it revolves around some vice, no doubt, that is dominating the members of that family, whatever it happens to be. We have loads of examples in our society. But what happens is that it doesn't make them unique. It makes them like every other family that is dominated by that particular vice or set of related vices. The happy ones are the saints. The ones that are unique are the saints. They're not all alike. They are really, really different. And happy families are really, really different too. Why? Because they're made up of between two, three, you know, say three, between three and six or eight or ten people who are completely different people. And they are all working out against one another like rocks in a tumbler. And the rock tumbler, you know, roll them around and around, and they get smoother, they get the edges knocked off. And so this is happiness? Yes, it's happiness. You get happy, your happiness is when you've got the edges knocked off, and then there you are. You know, you've been about the same spiritual effort together. And is each stone in the tumbler become not itself? No, it's itself. It's had its corners knocked off. You know, it's not dominated by some vice, nor is the family dominated by a set of family vices, because that happens. You know, and then you need to go, probably, all need to go to confession and maybe to a counselor, hopefully one that is familiar with Orthodox spirituality. There are such people. And you can get that mess sorted out so that you can get down to the business of doing the spiritual work that needs to be done so that you can have as a goal shared purity of heart. And if you have that goal, then you are moving toward the kingdom of God and things will be back on track. So that's the way it works. The truth is, unhappy families are more alike than unhappy. Unhappy families are alike. Happy families, each are happy in their own way. That would be the way to say it. That was my wrench that I was going to throw in. But then I didn't want somebody to take Tolstoy's point, and then, you know, I just said, no, you're wrong. You know, your way of looking at it is secular, like Tolstoy's. So, fortunately, you know, I had people who said, no, Tolstoy's full of baloney, you know, which he is. Anything people would like to talk about so far?
Well, I think the happy families, the happy ones, are when we can be more who we are created to be. You know, we have the vices and we go to confession and we do. But really, I think that's what it comes down to, that we can be real, that we can be who we're created to be.
How do we go about accomplishing that?
By confession, by looking, by having the, what do you call it? We just talked all about it. Just having the goal together as a family. And when we do have an argument, you know, looking at ourselves, seeing, you know, not doing what everybody else is doing.
Dealing with our own vices.
Yes.
Each one of us has our own vices. each one of us, in order to be able to function in a group relationship, family, ideally everyone will be dealing with their own vices. And when you're dealing with your own vices, you are going to be free to be able to be the person that God created you to be. Because the pursuit of virtue frees you from being dominated by your passions. If you're dominated by your passions, you're not able to be free to be the person that God created
right.
you to be.
And you're unhappy.
And you're unhappy.
You're driven by everything around you.
The advantage in the family is you are not going to be able to get along with other members of the family unless you are dealing with your own vices.
And it is work.
And you don't have, you don't have any choice about it. In a family, you cannot get away from it.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're going to blame somebody else, that other person is going to suffer on your behalf. As a parent, I would expect probably it's going to be the parents. But not always.
Can we deal with them on our own?
You have to. Nobody else can deal with them. We each have to deal with our own. Now, you don't have to worry about dealing with them on your own, in a sense, because you're a member of a family. And if you start making an effort to deal with your vices, people will notice. You know, and the person who starts making an effort to deal with their vices can actually be a source of encouragement and inspiration to other members of the family who, you know, if they love each other, will get alerted to the fact that, hey, maybe I need to start dealing with some of mine. And so it doesn't matter whether we're talking about the parent or the mother or the father or the brother or the sister. It works the same way. From every source of people who need to deal with their own vices. Yeah.
And like what you're saying, there have been times where I get really mad at Jimmy. But, you know, his response would be more gentle, which I'm, you know, he's obviously dealing with that, something there. And so a lot of times my reaction, I'm a little taken back. And then it helps me to look at myself and realize, oh, well, that's not, you know, maybe I'm thinking of things, bringing up past resentments or bringing, you know, so the kindness and the coming from one person help, personally, I can reflect on myself. So it's just kind of saying, I'm in a practical way, what you just said.
Right, right. We get in ruts.
That.
And as married people and in family life in general, and we go down the same trail, you know, and we recognize it. You know, I've been here before. You know, we even know just about what the other person's going to say before they say. We could almost hold up both ends of the conversation all by ourselves, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So because it's so familiar. But if somebody's making an effort on their own part, that's what throws Monkey Ranch into those, they used to call them tapes, you know, I don't know what you call them now, but, Father Tucker, is it Tucker, wrote this great book on you know, how to change the patterns of thinking that are controlling you. Nope, it's not Tucker, it's Trader, Father Alexis Trader. And the name of the book is Ancient Christian Wisdom and Aaron Beck's Cognitive Therapy. Because the way you think determines your life, right? So you can change the patterns that you've fallen into. That's possible. That could be done. If you went to an Orthodox Christian psychoanalyst, that's what they would be trying to help you to do. Not to be at the mercy of those tapes, you know, those pathways, you know, that we repeat over and over again. Okay. So the protective. Now I'm on page 105, first new paragraph. The protective instinct can be extremely helpful in our efforts to develop such Christian friendships in a family. The protective instinct, while it isn't the same thing as Christian love, can help as a catalyst to love. What's a catalyst?
Something that speeds something up.
Okay, like in a chemical reaction, there's a possible reaction between two elements, and there's something that if you add it, the chemical reaction will take place. So it sets it off. It initiates the possible development. And here, what can initiate this spiritual effort is this protective instinct, where you know it's something at a natural level, but still, if we have this instinct to be protective of our children, or to be protective of our brother or of our sister, that can make us make an effort to do something of a spiritual nature that isn't selfish. And we might realize, hey, I can only deal with this by dealing with some problem that I see is in me. So it arose out of a concern that is a natural level concern, even an instinct. So it can be a catalyst. It's not sufficient by itself, but it can be a catalyst in family relationships when that love that you have for the other person is based on unity of purpose, a concern for purity of heart. So if you have a concern for purity of heart in yourself and as a shared life with the other members of the family, and you have this instinct to be protective, you will be protective of the other members of the family at a spiritual level, because you don't want to mess up the development of this shared concern with purity of heart. So, see how that works? Can work. This is because the protective instinct helps drive virtuous behavior within families. If you have that unity of purpose, that concern with shared purity of heart, the protective instinct naturally spurs our desire to do good to one another in charity. I'm going to jump down to the next paragraph beyond this one here. The protective instinct creates a natural inclination to treat one another with compassion. We hate to see a family member suffering. This feeling makes it easier to accept their suffering as our own, so that when the other person is suffering, we are suffering, and we know that the only way to deal with that suffering is at a spiritual level. It's probably going to involve our not giving in to some vice that we have, but instead being compassionate, and so you see, you raise the level of your concern to a spiritual level. Parents are likely to understand this impulse to experience a child's pain for themselves. You know, anybody that you love very much, it's painful not to be able to share the pain of the other person, you know. One way of sharing the pain of the other person is to do something with yourself spiritually so that you can interact in a compassionate way with that person and love them, not in a selfish, natural kind of way, but in a more unselfish, spiritual kind of way. Whether the pain of the other person comes from a simple skinned knee or the far-reaching impact of sin in the world, we see our children suffering from bad spiritual choices in the world, it's more painful than when they fell and hurt their knee. And even if you're ancient and your kids are grown up and almost as old as you are, that kind of pain for what they're going through, it doesn't go away. When we see our family members struggling in their vices, we too struggle with those vices. We can struggle with those vices in ourselves. Because of the pain, it causes us to see a spouse or children suffer. In a family, the vices impact everyone in the home directly. The sins of our spouse or of our children become our own sins, and we have to deal with them, and we can within ourselves, whether we consent to them ourselves or not. If we consent to them, that's not dealing with them. If we don't consent to them, then we're dealing with them in a way that may be helpful to the other person, because it's affirming this common shared goal of purity of heart. Refusing to give it up. Refusing to give up on it. Okay, next page. Operwall says that this experience of having compassion for other members of the family, almost against your will, is like an experience of being thrust into compassion. Thrust into compassion for the other person because of your love for them. it can and should help to cultivate love within our family relationships. Our protective instinct helps us practice these virtues instinctively, and thus it happens, and for this reason, it can happen more often in a family than it might in a less intensive kind of relationship. That's the advantage of the natural love as a catalyst, which is so much present in family life. The protective instinct, when combined with a recognition of Christian love, introduces a powerful force into family life that is difficult to cultivate in any other relationship. This force is holy fear. Holy fear. Now, this is interesting, what he's going to do here. Fear, in the sense of fright, is the mark of a totally broken family relationship. For example, in a family relationship that involves abuse, that is not the kind of fear we're talking about. We mean something different by the words holy fear. We mean something totally the opposite of fright. We mean a fear of hurting one another, a fear of causing offense toward the love that we share in our family. Holy fear is the experience of terror at the thought of losing genuine Christian love. That's what holy fear is. The sublime fear of love, not being afraid of love, but the sublime fear that comes along with love. If we love someone, we are fearful of doing anything that will damage the holiness of that love. This fear is not from dread of punishment or from the desire for rewards. Rather, it is that fear by which the son honestly honors his father, a brother his brother, a friend her friend, a husband his wife. For they do not fear blows or insults, they fear any damage being done to their love, and they take diligent care, not just in everything they do, but in every word they speak, to make sure that nothing that they say would make lukewarm the other person's love. The fear of compromising our love for one another is a modality of the protective instinct. What he's saying here is that the fear of compromising our love for one another is a type of the protective fear, but it's a protective instinct at the spiritual level, where our concern is not about material worldly things. Our concern is about losing something that is holy and spiritual, and we're protective about that. And remember, that protective instinct, that's part of family life. That's natural to family life. So that's how something that is natural to family life can be a spur to spiritual effort. It is because of our instinctive knowledge that a loss of the love that we share with family members would cause pain in them, as well as in us. Our desire to protect a spouse or a child from pain becomes a desire to protect our love and their love for us. We don't want to offend their love or betray it, you see. And this desire leads us to fear the possibility of doing anything to jeopardize it. And here's the payoff. The fear of God is the same kind of fear as the fear of damaging our relationship of love with another family member. When we say the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, if our spiritual life can be governed by a fear of losing oneness with God in love, then we've gone way beyond the idea that, well, God is the authority, he has power, I want to do what I ought to do because I'm going to be punished. You know, it's completely different. So now we've gone from something that we can understand in family life because we love other members of the family and we want to protect that love and we're fearful of losing it. That is exactly what the fear of God is, the same kind of fear, fear of damaging our relationship of love. The fear of losing love within a family is quite literally a fear of God's absence in the family. Now we see how realistic this understanding of the fear of God is. The fear of losing love within a family is quite literally a fear of God's absence in the family. That is really something. if we, that's worth the price of the book. Okay, I'm going to let that lay there for a little bit. What do people think? Is this heading home?
I wrote myself a note.
A family is a holiness kit, assembly required. So a family is meant to be what we're describing. But the interesting thing about a family is that you have a family like this, it affects other people. You have a church like this, and people will start to come because it's the only place in town where that's going on. That's Orthodox evangelism. So family is important. Parish life is important. People will go because, you know, like in ancient times, the Romans said, look at these Christians. It's a new people. They're not Greeks. They're not Jews. They're not Romans. And yet they are a people, because you can look at them, see they're different than everybody else, and they somehow include all of us as human beings. That's Orthodox evangelization. To live that life. Not to go tell people, hey, you should believe this. No, hey, are you saved? Or even we as Orthodox would say, hey, are you being saved? No, that won't cut it either. You know? Because we're being saved. I mean, right there you start to doubt. Are you? Okay, so enough of the wrench. Anything else? Okay, I'm going to take a shot at finishing this section before we wrap it up, because we'll stop in the middle of the next page. When a husband looks at his wife and recognizes the anguish that she would feel if their love were broken, and when he desires in holy fear to protect her from this anguish, he seeks, by so doing, to protect her and their relationship from the anguish of separation from God. That's why the husband doesn't do things that are vicious, vices are vicious, that he might be tempted to do. Same thing the other way around. When a wife looks at her husband and sees her husband cherishing their Christian love for one another and desires to protect that feeling within him and make it grow, and he's saying, when at the same moment that the husband is doing what we just described, being concerned about their love being broken, and at the same time as he's doing that, the wife is looking at her husband and seeing her husband cherishing their Christian love for one another and desiring to protect that feeling within him and make it grow, she does what she can to preserve their love, and so feeds a divine cycle. So that both things are happening at the same time. It's like an engine. It's like a Wankel. I mean, nobody remembers a Wankel engine, probably. Everybody heard of the Wankel engine?
Oh, yeah.
I haven't asked for that before. You remember, yeah.
Wankel.
Wankel.
What's a Wankel?
A Wankel engine has no pistons. It's a rotary engine. There used to be a commercial years ago when they first started putting these in cars. And the commercial was something like a piston engine goes chook, 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 and a Wankel goes mmm. It was a great commercial.
What turns it?
Huh?
What turns it?
You have to look it up. You look up Wankel engine. They still use them in some cars.
I bought a new Mazda and went for a ride. Just me and my sweetie sitting side by side. A grand soul quiet, we talk by the hour. And a rotary engine gives you a quiet power.
It's an engine go. But the Mazda goes.
We took my Mazda out for a whirl. It's the perfect way to impress a girl. There's nothing like it on the road today. The rotary engine is here to stay. It's an engine go.
Because there's less friction in a Wankel. Anyway. Okay, so this is like a Wankel, I'm saying, because both of them enforce one another. It's like an engine. It's a cycle. See? That's where. In such a moment, both of them, husband and wife, know what is required for the continuation of the love that they wish to protect for the other. They must give themselves up to each other in an act of their mutual protective instinct. The work of mutual self-giving is the same act of humility that leads to unity of purpose. In so giving of themselves, a married couple yet further increases their holy fear. You see where holy fear comes in here, because you don't want this to stop. Desiring to pick up the slack of the protection of the other's love, on the cycle goes, if possible, into the infinite divine. One act of love feeding another, owing to the fear of dampening each other's love. The protective instinct, manifesting as holy fear, spills over to become genuine humility. Can you see how this would lead to humility? Because it's concern for the other person. It's holy fear, and it's this fear of God is involved with this. And thus, unity of purpose is the keystone of a family's capacity to make manifest, to make real, the kingdom of God. This beautiful cycle, however, is impossible unless good works, compassion, patience, and humility are exercised in family relationships. So this is an abstract, this is an idealism. It comes down to making a spiritual effort and dealing with your own vices, which the other person cannot do. And fortunately, though, it fits very well with humility and fear of God and fear of losing the holiness of the love that you have for one another. They all work together. Natural instinct itself is not enough to do this. Natural instinct, if you rely on that, things will fall apart. Because that's the nature of the natural world. Left to its own, it will fall apart. The scientists know that. They think we don't. When Christian families do seek one purpose by practicing the key virtues, the protective instinct helps them to become a powerful tool for reflecting and magnifying real love and building it up as a manifestation of the love and fear of God. In this way, family can become one of the most powerful tools of salvation available to the laity. Who's the laity? Me too. You know, even though I'm a priest, I'm also a member of the laity. Those two, the holy people of God. Because we're all baptized. People are ordained to do something in particular, to serve mainly at the altar. But when Opperwell says laity, thinking of John Cassian and the monks that he interviewed, he doesn't mean people who aren't priests, he means people who aren't monks. A layman in the desert.
He interviewed them?
John Cassian did, not Opperwell.
This is
in the 4th century. John Cassian's book is based on his interviewing people like Moses the Ethiopian and other monks of the desert. Mm-hmm. He went to the desert in the 4th century, interviewed these monks, wrote down what they said. That's what the book is that Opperwald is talking about. I brought a copy of it, you know, the first night.
Let's see.
Okay, that's it. Now, next, chastity and sex in married life. I have been requested that we pass over this section and leave it as a kind of a private section that we read on our own. And I do encourage you to read it. It's good. But it would be uncomfortable for us to discuss something so intimate in a public setting. So we'll let that go. And we'll go to chapter 4, Property and Work, which starts on page 129. However, there is one thing that I want to point out in this section before we do that, and that's on page 117, top of 117. By cultivating the virtues, the married couple seeks to link their sexuality not to the desires of their flesh, but rather to the genuine Christian love between themselves. The transformation in the mind, when this is accomplished, even in a small way, is remarkable. That's the key to this section, and I'm happy to point that out and go on. And I think that anybody who starts out without the seed of that desire, a spiritual desire in their relationship, I don't see how they're going to make it. Because if you've got nothing but natural love, I just don't know what hope there is for you. There has got to be at least the seed of the desire by loving the other person to go beyond natural love and physical passion.
And seek purity of heart.
Even if you get a little way. You know. So, okay. Next time, Chapter 4, Property and Work, page 129. Anyone would like to make a final comment or even a question, you know, please feel free to do that, because we're not that far over time, just a minute or two. Well, three now, maybe four.
No, back to when Sherry mentioned Jimmy, her getting mad at Jimmy, and Jimmy being nice back. It reminds you of the poles.
Yeah. Oh.
Of the hatred and love and how the counterbalancing it. And it shows humility on Jimmy's part, which is a good thing.
Uh-huh.
And Jude asked me a question the other day. Why do people fight and argue?
Uh-huh.
And he even brought divorce into it. And the only thing I could think to say was pride.
That's pride, yeah.
The only answer I could give him, that hopefully he'll understand.
Mm-hmm.
Remember.
It is pride and self.
Which is the opposite of the humility.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and what you're talking about, all of family, human being, I've got it in my pocket right here.
Life without prayer. Yeah, that really
that
is.
That subject is kind of brought up in here.
Yeah, it's a great.
It's a great little fire.
Metropolitan Anthony Bloom. So it's a great talk. That's why I made it into a folder. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.